I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Marita Grutzen, Deputy Director of the Stanford Geriatric Education Center, who will speak about fostering meaningful connections and healing rituals with those who are terminally ill. But first, we pay tribute to one of Israel's best-known writers, intellectuals, and advocates for peace, Amos Oz, who died on December 28th at the age of 79. Oz authored 40 books, including 14 novels, 5 collections of novellas and short stories, 2 children's books, and a dozen books of articles and essays. His political commentary and literary criticism appeared in numerous publications in Israel and in the U.S. And his writing has been translated into many languages and has been recognized by awards worldwide. His 2002 autobiographical novel, A Tale of Love and Darkness, inspired the 2015 film of the same name, directed by and starring Natalie Portman. In November of 2016, Amos Oz appeared at the JCCSF to present his last novel, Judas. Let's take a moment to listen to a brief excerpt from his appearance.
Then the last question is, what are you hopeful for today?
Sorry, please say this again.
What are you hopeful for today? There were a number of questions that were asking about what gives you hope. Today.
What gives me hope today? What gives me hope is the fact that people do change. Individuals change. Countries change. History changes. What looks to you like a terrible depression, and you are right, depression in history is not the end of history. There is no such thing as the end of history, with all due respect to Samuel Huntington, if anybody still remembers him. There is no end to history. There are ups and downs, tragic moments, and yes, some comical moments, you know it, and some tragic comical moments. But history is not over. People change. People even surprise themselves. I said this before. I'm not predicting anything at all about your president-elect. I know nothing about this man, and I'm not sure he knows. He has the slightest idea what really he is do, what can he and what can he not do. This is not the question. The question is that people do change. I was a peace activist in my 20s. When I put on my army uniform and my boots and went to fight a war in Sinai in 67 and again in the Golan Heights in 73. And as a peace activist and a peace advocate, if anyone told me then that in my lifetime, I will travel to Egypt with an Egyptian visa stamped in my Israeli passport. And I will travel to Jordan with a Jordanian visa stamped in my Israeli passport. I'd say, well, let's not get carried away. Maybe my children, more likely my grandchildren, not in my lifetime. And I was there several times. If anybody ever told me that I will live to see Sharon dispatching his bulldozers to erase his beloved colonies in Gaza, I would say let's not exaggerate. Maybe someone else will do it one day, not him. I'm not predicting anything. I'm just telling you, life is open-ended. People are open-ended. History is open-ended. And this is as much hope as a humble storyteller can offer you on a sad moment.
Amos Oz.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was author Amos Oz from his appearance at the JCCSF in November of 2016. He died on December 28th at the age of 79. And now on to our main program. Let's join Shiva Schultz on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Marita Grutzen, Deputy Director of the Stanford Geriatric Education Center, who will speak about fostering meaningful connections and healing rituals with those who are terminally ill.
Death is a subject that we're looking at today from a variety of viewpoints and in ways that we hope will allow you and your families, greater ease in opening doors into this territory. What I'd like to do is give you a bio of our first speaker, Marita Grudzin, who I am delighted is here today from San Jose. And she is the Associate Director Emerita of the Stanford Geriatric Education Center, Stanford School of Medicine, where her expertise is in spiritual and cultural diversity at the end of life. With her colleague, Jewish chaplain Bruce Feldstein, MD, she received a 5-year Templeton Award for required curriculum in the School of Medicine, Spirituality and Meaning in Medicine, as well as an elective course, The Healer's Art. A published author, her most recent article in the Journal of Aging, Religion and Spirituality in 2017 is entitled Ritual as a Pathway to Transcendence in the Lives of Older Adults. Ms. Grudzin has lectured extensively nationally and internationally, including Japan, Turkey, and Kenya. We're very, very fortunate to have her here today.
Good morning, everyone. One of my themes today is tenderness and devotion. I chose this slide, the backdrop, because it embodies the tenderness of life, that fragile being that we witness in flowers that have a short life. And one of my themes today is tenderness and devotion. So as you can see, our topic is love and death. Our topic is love and death, companioning, or we could say accompanying those we love as they die and celebrating or honoring their lives. I want to start by speaking for a moment about our topic. I think most of us know what death is. Although in Japan, my Buddhist scholar colleague has taught me they have 3 definitions of death. But we know what we mean here by death. Secondly, what is love? And love to me is our human capacity to connect and care about each other. That's what I'm talking about today, in our relationships with others. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my connection with the subject because it's a bit unusual. My own tradition is Catholic, and I was brought up in that the spiritual roots of that experience, which still are very much a part of my life. In fact, I entered contemplative life for 8 years, so I really have deepened myself in that tradition. I served clinically as a respiratory therapist at a local hospital here. And in that capacity, I was often with people in ICU or in the emergency room before and after death. Then the last 30 years, I have focused in my work. I have done 2 kinds of work. Shiva mentioned my work with medical students, which is required curriculum now. So all medical students have to be able to identify their own spiritual beliefs and be able to interview their patients about their spirituality and meaning in life. So I'm very grateful for my work in that area. The second area, which really most of my time and energy went into, is in the field of ethnogeriatrics, which is healthcare for ethnically diverse elders. And I worked with a number of different groups of elders. We have so much wonderful diversity here in the Bay Area. And the purpose was to be able to train doctors and nurses, which I've done extensively in this country and abroad, as well as chaplains, in how to relate and negotiate, in a sense, with elders and people at the end of life who may believe differently than you, and also who may perceive the cause of their death as different from what you as a professional might or a family member might know is the cause of death. I also have cared in my home for family members who have been dying. I've been asked by friends to accompany them in their dying process, and neighbors as well. Also, in my professional life, I had the experience of co-facilitating groups of professionals who were debriefing from their experience as hospice nurses or chaplains, or I did a group for physicians, for nurses, and working also with specific hospice groups. And so they have shared in that circle format what is still concerning them, maybe, about a patient that they had worked with. Maybe it was a sense that the patient died angry and they were trying to change that. Or I remember a woman whose father was very active in their church, who became very anxious at the time of death. And that was such a, she didn't know how to handle that because he was the spiritual leader. So there are always concerns and issues that come up for us. What I'd like to do now is to take a moment to dedicate our time together for a purpose, a person, for yourself, for someone who died or you know is dying. So because I believe that the time that we attend to come close to death, that whatever time we devote to that actually is a way of creating peace in the world. I feel very strongly about that because it requires courage, it requires setting aside our own agenda and to be present, to take off our head, to tend to our emotions, right? If we truly are there to companion someone. And we'll talk about different ways of doing that. But for myself right now, I'm dedicating this to the experience of what's happening with the campfire. I don't think I need to go into detail on that. It's very present to us in our emotions, in our bodies, with the air we're breathing. So, but I want each of you to take time to think of how you want to use this time, how you want to dedicate it. My intention today is to focus on some of the human and relational experiences that emerge in our care of those that we love, and whether we're a family member or whether we're a friend or neighbor, that extension. So looking at the human and the relational, and I wanted to honor Viktor Frankl because we're here in this Jewish center, and because he's so exquisitely defines what it is to be human. And he relates it to frail aging and dying. And I had the opportunity in 1989 to hear him at the American Society on Aging, where he took his creation, logotherapy, and applied it to aging, to his own aging. It was 7 years before he died. He was 85 when he presented. He was a very fortunate man to live in good health and good mind until he was 92, almost 93. Does anyone not know who Viktor Frankl is or haven't heard his name? Okay, good. I'm glad. Thank you. So Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychiatrist who was in Auschwitz. There he lost both his parents, his beloved wife, and his brother. They were all gassed in the chamber. He survived. In 1926, when he was a young man in his 20s, he developed a form of psychotherapy called logotherapy. So this was before his experience at Auschwitz. And many people think he developed it coming out of those Jewish concentration camps. But he said it was a tragic field where I saw it lived and practiced. It was a tragic human laboratory, as he said. So this man developed this form of therapy, which he promulgated through his writings, particularly the book Man's Search for Meaning. And he wanted that book to be for the man on the street. It wasn't a theoretical book. It actually was first entitled From Death Camp to Existentialism. But he found that was not a very appealing title to pick up at your bookstore. So he changed it. And of course, it does speak directly to that sense of man's search for meaning. He received several international awards, 28 different honorary degrees. That book has been translated into 25 different languages. And he's actually written 33 books, but I really want to focus on the heart of logotherapy and on man's search for meaning. So that is the man. And what is logotherapy? Logotherapy is a practice of psychotherapy that assists the individual in finding their source of meaning. Now, Viktor Frankl said we can never give anyone meaning. And that meaning does not dwell in us. It dwells outside us. It's that that we each have to find for ourselves. And in fact, he has pointed out that each of us is based on the different experiences that have flowed into our life, and our genetics and everything that makes us who we are. He was very holistic in his view of the human person. He said everyone is unique, and their source of meaning has to necessarily be a unique expression of who they are, because of the way that we're formed, because of our own interest and participation. So he went on to say that finding meaning, particularly in the area of suffering, is the greatest fulfillment of humanity, of our humanness. He definitely expressed that he felt we were spiritual beings. And he was a little hesitant to align with religion specifically. But he said we're much more than our biological urges and our unconscious instincts. We have this unconscious source of spirituality that we see when we see it in many instances. But certainly, as we experience our conscience, we have this experience of our spiritual self.
You're listening to Marita Grutzen, Deputy Director of the Stanford Geriatric Education Center, speaking about fostering meaningful connections and healing rituals with those who are terminally ill. On Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
He talked about the three things that we all have to face. We have to deal with guilt, the things we haven't done or the things that we've offended or hurt others with. We have to deal with suffering, and we have to deal with death. And he felt that we deal with guilt by the impulse to improve ourselves. And it's always that desire to transcend ourselves, to go to that, to go beyond ourselves. It can be as simple as our not feeling well and getting up and giving a seat on the bus to a pregnant woman or a frail elder. Or it can be as dramatic as the story that we heard 2 or 3 years ago, which happened in a New York subway, where someone had jumped on the tracks, and within a minute, less than a minute actually, but a father, a young father, asked people next to him to watch his children, and he jumped down and pulled that person away from the tracks, and they both were saved. Now that is a very dramatic portrayal of what it means to transcend ourselves, but it's also a practice. It's a practice of finding meaning by transcending and offering something for someone else. I wanted to read you, just in closing on logotherapy, a couple of quotes directly from him. Being human means relating and being directed to something other than oneself. Our true freedom lies in our ability to respond, if only by the adoption of a certain attitude. So that would be the case if we were suffering. How to assume an attitude in enduring that. I'm going to, let me read, the meaning of suffering we have to find outside ourselves by the way we face our distress. We must live as a responsible human being to our own distinctive self, in response to our own distinctive self and the context in which we live. And we have to be comfortable with the being the other. In other words, our own distinctive self. We cannot project on other people what we find meaningful to do. So there's no way that Viktor Frankl, if he were here today, would encourage us all to respond in a particular way to our current situation, or your situation in your home or in our city. So our theme is very personal, and the essence of speaks to the essence of what it means to be human. So I'm not going to give a fast-paced lecture, because inevitably, when we're talking about death, it does bring up personal memories and emotions. So we want to honor the integrity of what is shared as we listen to one another. So now that we just spoke about Viktor Frankl and logotherapy, I know that was a quick overview of his basic perspective, which has been honored. Logotherapy has been honored as one of three international forms of psychotherapy. So he's received, as I mentioned, many honorary degrees and honors from his own profession. So are there any comments or questions about that before we go on?
Could you say more about what logotherapy is as opposed to other types of therapy? I mean, it specifically.
Yes. Well, for example, psychotherapy often enables us through our interaction with the therapist to cope with what is going on in our life, either internally or externally. Logotherapy is if you were a logotherapist, you would first of all establish your relationship, as would be true in other kinds of therapy, an empathetic relationship. And then, let's say that you were working with an older person, you would spend time eliciting from that person's history what their values are and the kinds of commitments and deeds that they have performed, the way they have invested themselves earlier in their life. And then, from that, You can never, as I said, give a person meaning, but you can be present with them in a way that helps them identify what might be meaningful right now. So, for example, my mother-in-law, when she was dying in the hospital, she was a woman that used to love to go to bingo. And at her local bingo, she became friends with many young women who were struggling. And when she was in the hospital dying, she was not receiving food or water. She continued to interact in a personal way with a particular nurse's aide who was struggling at home. And my mother-in-law elicited from her what her life was like and such. And so for my mother-in-law, that capacity to invest and to care about someone else, this is something she had done all her life. It just emerged naturally in that situation. And so the focus is not on coping, but it's on transcending yourself in any particular situation. He says, Frankl says, our whole life is a search for meaning. So I don't mean that we spend our whole life searching for it, but across the lifespan, we are looking for meaning in our particular situation at a particular time. And he says that is what fulfills us as a human being.
Do you know why it's called logotherapy?
Yes, logo refers to the meaning in Latin. Yes, so it has to do with meaning in particular. Thank you for asking that. So I also had the opportunity to work with colleagues who were very close to Frankl and who went to Austria to study with him and who visited Auschwitz with him. And so I'm going to share a little bit from their writings. Frankl wrote in his Man's Search for Meaning that meaning, while it cannot be created, only discovered, can be found in three ways. He was speaking particularly to the frail person or someone who's handicapped or very limited. The first, he said, by creating a work or doing a deed. So we talked about getting up and giving our seat. But for a frail person, there are many ways that they could extend themselves so that someone else is taken care of first, or where they are able through some creativity within themselves to create even in their frailty. And I'm remembering a friend of mine at Stanford, a physicist, he was an inventor. He had a serious heart attack. Afterwards, he was going to the YMCA for cardiac rehab. Are any of you familiar with that, where nurses are present and you exercise under supervision? Well, he created an exercise program in the form of a line dance. He loved line dancing. So he knew how to work with the syncopation and the rhythm in order to get adequate exercise. So that's one example. Another example could be attending to someone by reading to them, or by establishing a relationship with them. So it's this use of creativity or actually establishing something. The second way is by experiencing something or encountering someone. And here Frankl is talking about relationship, the capacity to invest in another person. So just as I mentioned my mother-in-law investing in her concern in her caretaker, Frankl points out how important relationship is, and how by investing and listening and getting to know another person, what's important to them, what hurts them, what interests them, what gives them pleasure. And that kind of investment is something that we can do and is a way to transcend ourselves. And the third way is by the attitude we take toward unavoidable suffering. And later he went on to describe logotherapy in those in similar ways, so I'm not going to go into the next form. So remember at the beginning I said I use that expression of the flowers because I think of Elizabeth Barrett Browning when I think of caring for another human being. It really takes our sensibility, our sense of knowing that person and what would give them comfort, our attention to them that makes companioning so efficacious. So the first thing, of course, when we talk about companioning someone that we love is we look at our relationship. What is our relationship with them and with their family, if they have a family in the area? And it's so important to realize that distance is not a barrier. In other words, we have the capacity. Remember Frankl talking about that we are spiritual beings, and we have the capacity, especially if we practice it, of being able to be in communion in a felt way with another person despite the distance between us. And so as I point out here, distance is not a barrier to our spiritual connection and our ability to support. But that is something that requires that we develop it. We have to be able, if we are the main caregiver or part of a large circle of family and friends, it's so important to be able to share that burden by looking at what each person can and is capable of giving and eliciting that in a voluntary way. Sometimes it's designated to the oldest daughter, and there aren't other people that are sharing that responsibility. So we know that everyone is not comfortable going on hospice. Some people, religious people, feel that if they go on hospice, that they are not affirming their belief that God will assist them. That by saying they will receive no more treatments, that they are declaring that they're giving up hope. And in San Jose, I worked with Dr. Bill Fowkes, who was able to work with Sutter Hospice at the time to fashion the statement in such a way that it would honor someone's spiritual faith and would clarify for them that they weren't giving up hope. So the other thing is looking at our own availability and our own, given our relationship with a particular person, what are we able at this time in our life, in our present context, what are we able to contribute? And we have to look at our emotions as well. If we have just been through difficult emotional experiences, we don't have that emotional flexibility or reserve, maybe to be present in a way with our friend that is dying, that does not bring that, that does not bring our own sense of inner turmoil or distress. So this is how we have to assess how we want to contribute, if it's in physical ways, if it's in presence to the person. We can offer our presence, our healing energies, our capacities to serve. And one of the most powerful ways of serving is by listening, by just being that presence, that companion. Because there are things that come to those we love that are dying. They may be a need for reconciliation. It may be a need to, I remember a situation where a woman wanted to dictate her own obituary. She wanted to know what was going to be in the paper about her. Several people have wanted to have certain fashion part of the memorial service. People talk about dreams. Dreams are very powerful at the end of life. They often communicate concerns or they reflect what's going on externally. And it's very helpful for people just to share what their dream is. Gentle massage is often very helpful to people. One of my good friends just visited a friend of over 50 years who was in a coma. And she was telling me about that experience, how she gently massaged her hands and her feet, how she reminisced with her, even though the woman was in a coma. She spoke about their special times in the past. I remember when I was working as a respiratory therapist, many times in a hospital setting, the family was not comfortable touching their loved one, especially if they were in a coma. And touch is so important. There's one time that touch is not appropriate, and that has to do... If in certain Buddhist traditions, they want to be in a certain state of spiritual awareness where they are not disturbed, and they understand that as affecting their life after death. And I only know that because I'm working at Stanford right now on a research project to make sure that the spiritual needs of people are are inquired about if they are hours or days to death, expected to die, so that they are asked what their preferences are.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Marita Grutzen, Deputy Director of the Stanford Geriatric Education Center, speaking about fostering meaningful connections and healing rituals with those who are terminally ill. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Sometimes people find a lot of comfort from being able either to be outside in nature or to feel the gentle breeze, to be near a fountain. I don't know how many of you have been to Laguna Honda. The old Laguna Honda had its hospice unit had access to a garden. And when someone was dying, they would put the person in the room positioned closest to the fountain, and they would hear that that water. And there are many stories about my working at hospice in San Francisco with the social workers and nurses and doctor and chaplains there. That taught me a great deal. So the most important thing is being that listening presence, if we can be that. And speaking of Laguna Honda, the Zen Hospice Project, have any of you heard of that? I mention that because Zen Hospice had a 40-hour training for all the volunteers that worked at Laguna Honda. And they would begin by with a brief meditation where they would set aside their own preoccupations, pay attention to what was running through their mind, and before they would go out and sit with the patients that they were accompanying. And they would do that afterwards, too. They would sit after their period of time. There's so many wonderful books that have taught me a great deal. And these are some of them. And I want to mention one in particular right now. And that is Care for the Dying, the Doula Approach to a Meaningful Life. Here in San Francisco, this is one of the areas where training is being done by the International Association of End-of-Life Doulas. We know that doulas help midwives and women giving birth, and this is a new expression of that. And there are people that I've been meeting who are taking this doula training program. And it has many components, including assisting the family with care of the body before and after death, helping develop a ritual and a vigil at the end of life with the dying person and their family. They also do guided imagery to help the person relax and connect with what is healing for them. They meet with the family afterwards in terms of helping with the grieving process. So the doula program is a new resource, particularly in this area in San Francisco. Many people have been trained. I want to speak for a minute about honoring those who have died and celebrating their lives. There are so many different ways of doing that. And sometimes it's in a personal way. Sometimes it's in a community context, we know that many religious traditions provide a way to remember our beloved ones, to bless them. There's a ritual for burying them. But I'll just mention a few personal ones. A psychiatrist friend of mine who had cared for his neighbor boy of 16 and cared on a daily basis. He was retired. And it was so difficult for him. The death affected their family very much. And my psychiatrist friend is an artist. And he entered into communion with this boy by drawing him. And another young woman created a dance to honor her father. And the family did not want her to perform that dance at the religious ceremony. So they did agree to have her perform it in the funeral home when the family was viewing the body. Judi Dench, who some of you may know, the British actress, she plants trees to remember those that have been close to her, and including her husband. And for her, that tree goes on living and contributing to the environment, and that's the way she feels about her loved ones who have died. So I'm going to end with a letter written by a granddaughter to her grandmother. Dear Grandma, when I heard from my mom that your condition was getting more and more serious, I began to hurt more and more. At first I was angry, and then confused, and then numb. But now I don't feel any of those things, because all I can feel is you, your presence. However unaware you are, each and every one of your grandchildren has been forever loved and influenced by you. And although I've spent most of my life missing you and distanced from you, you have always been and always will be with me. You have instilled in me the kind of strength that will endure my struggle, as it did yours. And where it is that you are going, I will also be someday. Everything that you have taught me guides me. I know that you knew pain in your life, but I also know that you knew joy, and I hope you are letting go of the pain. I want more than anything to be by your side now, but fate has it that I am not. But please realize that your face is in my thoughts every waking moment, reminding me that I can, as you do, live with both dignity and compassion. I respect and love you more than I can ever say. As I said, you are with me now and always. Please know that you live through us. Grandma, you are the most beautiful woman I will ever know. I have always lived in awe of you. I will miss you, and I hope that you will be visiting me in my dreams and watch me from the heavens. I love you, Grandma. Simone. That was written by an 18-year-old girl to her grandmother who was dying 3,000 miles away. And it's interesting that grandma, in her last days, she was a very private person. So she got the letter, and she put it in a drawer. And the next day, she took it out. And she asked it be pinned above her bed. And then she began having the nurses read it to her. So it may seem like a simple thing to write, but we feel the power in that. And that letter was the only thing buried with her grandmother in her hands. So I'm going to stop there, and I hope that that it has served you in some way. And I'd like to know if any of you have questions or comments.
I appreciate greatly that you earlier spoke about distance with a loved one, because I was 2,000 miles away from my mom, and that has been an overarching theme, and it was very healing to hear you talk about that physical distance.
Yes, yes. There's no question in my mind that we can support a person who is dying at a distance from us through our connection with them. But we have to bring a focus and quiet time to do that. Yes, sir.
I'd like to make a suggestion, if you will. Literature on dying, the Dalai Lama's book, Advice on Dying and Leading a Better Life, Living a Better Life.
Wonderful, wonderful. I will add that.
This is an excellent book because it's the science of dying, the transformation, and the incarnation. So I want to share that book. The other publication by Tuttle is called Japanese Death Poems. This is to do with the shoguns, the samurais, there's haiku. And actually, this publication, if I can remember all this, was sponsored by the Science and Humanities in Israel.
Marvelous.
That was put into the publication. But this book is very, you read it very slowly because there's haiku and the Zen monks. And the, like you were illustrating in the introduction, the flowers, how flowers bloom and then they die. And there's quite a comparison in this publication. And so the other comment I wanted to make is that listening, not only when the person is alive, but when they die, they're also still listening. So I just wanted to share that.
Thank you. Thank you.
I wonder if you could say a little more about finding the meaning in suffering.
Well, of course, there are many different kinds of suffering. There's the suffering of isolation and being separated from others. There's physical suffering. There's spiritual distress. And also around the end of life, there is the sense of being a burden. And all of those would have different ways of relating to them. There is a woman by the name of Jane Tebow. I'm going to address one of those kinds, and that is physical suffering. There is a woman by the name of Jane Tebow who had a very difficult experience with cancer herself. But prior to that, she had worked with people because of her belief that suffering can benefit, that our acceptance of suffering can benefit another human being. And she worked with that theme with individual patients and trained chaplains to drop that idea and to see, for example, if it's possible for a person to accept their suffering, even for a brief period, on behalf of someone else. So I could give you her name and send you her books, but she has developed that theme. In terms of, well, I think that's the type of suffering you were referring to. Is it of the four that I mentioned? Mental suffering or spiritual?
I think it was, the first one I think you mentioned about isolation. And
isolation, right,
and
right.
Of, yeah.
Yes. Well, I think what that is That's something we experience even when we're ill, isn't it? When we're confined to our home, if we're living alone, we're separated from our everyday activities, our ways of contributing, and from contact with people. So I think what is essential in that that particular area is to, with whatever capacity we have, to reach out and to express that we need companionship. Now, I'm thinking in particular of a woman in her 90s in a nursing home who all of her all of her siblings had died. One of her son had died. She still had a daughter at a distance. And she had two grandchildren that had died in an automobile accident. And the nurse that took care of her had moved to another facility. And so even though she's sitting lying in a nursing home, she felt very isolated because these human connections meant so much to her. So in that case, staff need to know that and start to process that with her, you know, maybe to assign someone just to make sure that relationship is developed. And it's very hard because there are so many emotions that surface, you know, anger and depression.
You brought up about the doula training, and Final Passages is a resource table that's out there that does the training in the Bay Area. It's one of the organizations that does that.
Marvelous. Thank you. Okay. I was unaware of that.
The other thing is we have 4 near-death experience groups in the Bay Area, if people have an interest from that angle, from that point of view. So it's IANDS.org.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Marita Grutzen, Deputy Director of the Stanford Geriatric Education Center, speaking about fostering meaningful connections and healing rituals with those who are terminally ill. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espalay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pementuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.